I was a second string team member, a Johnny come lately, added to the team after the project was well underway. So when the group paused recently to reflect on how far they had come on their journey together, I sat quietly, listening to the stories of the first stringers. By any account, the project was an enormous undertaking, mobilizing the United Methodist denomination to raise $75 million for the purpose of eradicating malaria in sub-Saharan Africa. One by one, the leaders of the group remembered their early hopes and expectations that seemed, in hindsight, almost naive. Built as they were around a belief that churches around the country would rally eagerly and quickly to the cause, and that the fundraising goal of around $10 per member would be surpassed in no time flat. I sat quietly, thinking back on my own first impressions of the campaign when it was announced 5 or 6 years ago. It was one of four new emphases meant to bring life and vitality to the United Methodist Church. The other three goals were no-brainers. Leadership development, especially the development of new and younger and different kinds of leaders. The creation of new faith communities and new churches for persons who could never feel at home in existing churches, and ministry with the poor. These seemed like such obvious choices for a denomination whose glory days, many thought, had come and gone. But the fourth goal, stamping out the killer diseases of poverty around the world, seemed different, outlandish, perhaps even preposterous. I remember my Presbyterian friend Beth Dubois teasing me about such a wild and impossibly ambitious goal, and I had no rebuttal to offer. When the first stringers were done remembering, the leader of the group turned to three of us who had joined the group over the past 2 years and said he wanted to hear about our first impressions too. I confess that I really didn't know what I was getting myself into when I said yes, which is probably true of lots of my life. And then in some ways, a year and a half later, I still don't know. But no matter what, the experience is transforming my life in profound ways. Frankly, I agreed to join the group because a friend invited me. I did not understand at that time how closely the goal of eradicating the global diseases of poverty would tie into the commitment I made 4.5 years ago to work to end poverty in this community and this country. I did not understand back then how working to wipe out malaria in Africa would help me appreciate the hardships experienced by many of the African families in this very congregation. I did not understand how working on a global issue would put me back in touch with my early plans and calling in life to be an international diplomat. I didn't say all of that out loud to the group. Instead, I simply acknowledged that having said yes to the unknown, my life has been changed and transformed in ways I could never imagine. You see, it's the very audacity of the goal that makes it worth pursuing, because it moves us beyond institutional concerns and institutional agenda and institutional issues and preservation into a place where God is at work healing and saving the world, and where God alone knows and controls the outcome. To be a follower of Jesus is to say yes to something, to a reality that is far, far bigger than what we can see or dream on our own. In the story Jesus tells today, I am convinced that the primary and fatal sin of the rich man is not his lack of compassion nor his lack of generosity, but it is his blindness. His failure to see what and who was right outside his door, as well as his failure to see the possibility of a world remade in the fullness of God, a world made new in the fullness of Christ. To have faith in God is to be convinced that our lives and the world are not helplessly and hopelessly frozen in time, but can become better. And that our great calling is to help make that happen every way we can, each and every day of our lives. So easy for me to point my finger at the rich man in Jesus' story and tell myself that I would never be that callous and uncaring, but it's a whole different matter to realize that if his real crime is one of spiritual and moral blindness, then I have my own blind spots too. Places where I assume that misfortune and unhappiness and inequity and injustice are all given. Simply the way life is. And there's nothing that I or anyone else can do about it. Joining the Imagine No Malaria team was a wake-up call for me, every bit as much as circles had been a wake-up call for me before. That church is not just about getting close to God in the company of people I know and like and in a way that makes me feel good and comfortable, but that it's about joining God in a life-changing adventure to save the world and lives, both my own and those of my neighbors near and far, and that those can never be separated. If church is only about getting my own needs met, then I really don't need church at all. Like the rich man in the story, I can work on that agenda anywhere. Unfortunately, one of the primary reasons young adults have given up on the church is that they have come to see us as way too self-serving and self-indulgent, way too complacent and judgmental, when what they want to do is to find themselves by giving themselves, giving their life over to some great life-changing, life-altering, life saving cause. Lillian Daniel, a favorite author of mine, opens her new book by declaring how sick and tired and fed up she is with persons who like to loudly and proudly proclaim that they are spiritual but not religious, which is to say that they want to connect with God without having to rub shoulders with other human beings, that they want a spiritual encounter and experience free of all social responsibility. One former churchgoer put it this way in explaining to her his rationale for dropping out of church, that he said, along with seeing God and Mother Nature in trees and butterflies and beautiful sunsets, he had come to appreciate the innate goodness in his son, who had arrived on his own to some profound observations about the world and life. Listen to what my son wrote, he told Reverend Daniel. Children are starving with empty bellies in faraway lands. They have nothing to eat. All around them they hear the sounds of gunfire and bombs, and it made me realize that we are so lucky. We are so lucky to be living here and not there. I had tears in my eyes, the proud parent went on. I had tears in my eyes when my son said that. I realized to myself, he gets it, he really gets it. That's our religion, gratitude. At that moment when he recognized all that suffering and how fortunate he was, I could not have been prouder. End of quote. Gratitude is indeed a good and godly virtue. But gratitude that distances or isolates us from the suffering of others, gratitude that turns suffering into an unfortunate background to our own blessed lives, gratitude where suffering carries no more urgency about it than the bloody gore of a video game, marks us as 21st century brothers and sisters of the rich man who did absolutely nothing about the suffering right outside his door. But Jesus has something to say about that kind of self-serving gratitude and self-serving religion, that it may very well bring us comfort and pleasure this side of heaven, but that's as far as it will take us. Heaven, says Jesus, is where we come to see that God cares deeply and passionately and eternally about the poor and desolate, and that you and I are called to join God in doing something to make this world better, fairer, juster for all. Amen.